Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
There are cases that break the world cleanly in two. Cases where guilt and innocence rise like clear silhouettes against the sky. Cases where the moral lines are sharp, the facts are blunt, and the narrative is so clear that the public instinctively knows where to stand before the attorneys even assemble their opening statements. Then there are cases like the one we're looking at right now. The fatal crash on Pacific Coast Highway that took the lives of four Pepperdine University students, a case that refuses to sit neatly in one box, a case that demands the audience step back, breathe, and actually think about what justice means. Because here, justice is not a straight line. It is a set of intersecting paths, each one shaped by law, emotion, morality, and the very fragile human nature sitting underneath it all. Four young women, Mima Rolston, Peyton Stewart, Asha Weir, and Deslyn Williams, are dead. They were walking along the shoulder of a road. They had every right to be on. They were students, friends, daughters, full of futures that were erased before they even had a chance to unfold. And the man accused of causing their deaths, 22-year-old Frazier Michael Bohm, was allegedly driving more than 100 miles per hour, 104, in a 45-mile-per-hour zone on a notoriously deadly curve that he knew the risks about. The instinctive reaction is immediate. How could anyone do that? How could someone make such reckless choices? And why should he not be held to the fullest possible accountability? And those questions are valid. They are human. They're rooted in empathy for the victims and outrage for the senseless tragedy. And for many people, they form the entire emotional foundation of this case. But a courtroom doesn't work off instinct. It doesn't operate on emotional gravity. It doesn't ask whether the tragedy is large enough to demand murder charges. It asks whether the defendant's mindset meets a specific legal definition. And this is where the case becomes complicated, uncomfortable, and in some ways one of the most important criminal trials that we've seen in a long time. Not because it's sensational, but because it forces us to examine where the line between recklessness and murder really lies. Because there is a line, at least by the law, there is. The prosecution believes the line was crossed. The defense believes it wasn't. And the truth, the full, nuanced truth, lives somewhere mixed in. It's in a difficult, murky middle. The prosecution's argument begins with something very simple. The law, specifically the law of implied malice murder in California. It doesn't require hatred. It doesn't require a plan. It doesn't require the kind of intent we associate with traditional homicide. Implied malice says something different. It says, if you know your actions are dangerous to human life and you deliberately engage in them anyway, and someone dies as a result, that is murder. The prosecution says that's exactly what happened. They point to the black box data showing the BMW accelerating to 104 miles per hour. They point to Bohm's own statement that he knew the road like the back of his hand. They point to the history of friends lost to high-speed crashes, tragedies that should have been front of mind warnings. They point to stability control activating and the car still accelerating. They point to everything that signals an awareness of danger. Their argument is simple. You don't need to want someone dead to be held responsible for their deaths. You just need to knowingly create a deadly situation. And in their view, Bohm didn't just create one, he embraced it. But shift your perspective, okay? This is what we like to do here. We like to try and see things from all angles because it ends up helping you see things more clearly. We're not just all over here or over here. Reality is usually somewhere in the middle. And if you can sit here on any case, no matter what it is we're talking about, and go, I can try and understand it that way, I can try and understand it this way, you are the better person. So let's shift our perspective for a moment, turn a few degrees. And the defense argument begins to reveal its own moral and legal weight. They argue that tragedies, even preventable tragedies, do not automatically equal murder. They argue that if we take the result of an action, no matter how horrific, and let it define the crime, we risk bending the law until it becomes reactionary instead of reasoned. The defense says that Bohm made a terrible decision, but not a malicious one. They say he wasn't impaired. He wasn't drunk, high, or intentionally joyriding for entertainment. They challenge the idea that he understood in real time the lethal risk he was creating. They suggest he may have accelerated in panic in reaction to another aggressive driver. They point out that he has a clean record, no DUIs, no prior reckless driving charges, no history of legal trouble, and one could very easily put a dot, 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 yet at the end of all of that. He is rather young. But they're asking you to understand where things are right now. Their thesis, a moment of reckless judgment, even a catastrophic judgment, is not the same as conscious disregard for human life. And when you take emotion out of it, the argument holds some weight. Because the law isn't just about punishment, it's about precision. It draws lines not because it likes complexity, but because complexity is necessary. Without lines, everything becomes chaos. And if we charge every fatal crash as murder, where does that leave us? What happens to gradations of culpability, to the difference between negligence and malice, to the difference between mistakes and intentions, to the legal meaning of the word murder itself? The prosecution answers those questions forcefully. This is not every fatal crash. And they're right. The evidence clearly points towards extreme speed, extreme risk, and extreme disregard. Prosecutors are not trying to criminalize all speeding. They're trying to criminalize conduct that crossed a threshold. Conduct so dangerous, so foreseeable in its potential harm that it becomes indistinguishable from the kind of disregard the law
calls malice. But again, the defense pushes back. Intent matters. Mindset matters. Consciousness matters. Being a reckless 22-year-old with an overpowered vehicle doesn't automatically equate to murder. Human beings misjudge. Human beings panic. Human beings overestimate their skill behind the wheel. The defense says if the law doesn't require proof of actual awareness, but allows awareness to be interpreted purely from outcome, then we lose the very thing that separates criminal negligence from criminal intent. The prosecution counters with the question that sits at the heart of this entire case. How could he not be aware? How could someone who knows the road, who's been and seen in its dangers, experienced them, who has experienced the loss of friends, not understand the risk of accelerating at 104 miles per hour on that specific stretch? How could he be so ignorant? And that is a powerful question and a fair one, an emotionally resonant question, a morally compelling question. But is it a legally conclusive one? That's where the jury will have to go further, deeper than most jurors ever have to go. They're going to have to separate awareness from assumption. They're going to have to decide whether Bohm's understanding of the road translates into an understanding of risk at triple-digit speeds. They'll have to decide whether this was panic, adrenaline, stupidity, entitlement, conscious disregard, a little mix of all of them. And the uncomfortable truth is that those things often blur together. That is what makes this case so haunting and so difficult and so important. Because what we're really trying to figure out isn't just what Bohm did. It's what he knew, what he understood, what he meant, what he disregarded, what he feared, and what he failed to consider in the seconds leading up to the crash. And those are questions that cannot be answered simply by looking at the aftermath. The prosecution says the aftermath reveals everything, the physics, the data, the severity, the behavior. They believe the evidence shows a pattern of escalating recklessness, one that any reasonable adult knows is dangerous. They argue that consciousness can be inferred from the totality of actions, not just from spoken admissions. And they believe that if society wants to prevent tragedies like this, the law must treat extreme recklessness with the same extreme seriousness. The defense says the aftermath can't speak for the mind. They argue that people often misjudge danger, even when danger seems obvious to others. They'll emphasize the law requires subjective awareness, not hypothetical awareness. And they warn that if we start measuring consciousness by outcome, we risk criminalizing tragedy rather than punishing intent. That's the gravity of this case. Both sides are right in different ways. Both sides articulate truths that exist simultaneously. Both sides speak to values we want reflected in justice. Because we want a world where grief is honored. We want a world where recklessness has consequences. We want a world where the deaths of four young women matter deeply. But we also want a world where criminal charges are applied carefully, consistently, and without emotional distortion. A world where the law recognizes shades of intention. A world where punishment reflects not only what happened, but why it happened. And so we end up here, looking at a tragedy that sits exactly at the uncomfortable intersection of all those values. A case that asks us to hold two truths that feel like opposites yet coexist in the same space. Frazier Bohm's decisions were catastrophic, reckless, and devastating. At the same time, determining whether they were malicious, under the law's definition, is a profoundly complicated question.
The pain of the victims' families is unimaginable. The consequences for Bohm are life-altering. And one, many may say, life-ending. Not in the sense that he should be executed, although some may argue that too. But in a way that you should go away for the rest of your life now that you've taken four for your foolishness. You no longer serve a purpose out here with the rest of us. And maybe that's right. The implications for our legal system are broad. The moral landscape is jagged. This is not a case with clean edges. This is a case that forces us to stare directly at the messy overlap between tragedy and crime, between recklessness and malice, between what we feel and what we can prove. And what happened? What is reality? So maybe the point isn't to decide which side is right. Maybe the point is to see both sides clearly enough that we understand why this case matters, why it sets the stage for a conversation much bigger than one driver or one crash, why it forces us to examine how we handle the cost of human error in a world where the tools we use, cars, roads, laws, emotions, are imperfect. And maybe at the end of all this, the most responsible thing any of us can do is acknowledge that this case lives in a space where certainty is dangerous and thoughtfulness is necessary. Because this isn't just a legal case, it's a mirror, a question, a reckoning, a story about responsibility, tragedy, and the limits of intention. And it demands not outrage, but reflection to find the truth in the matter. What do you think? Where should this go? When I look at it from both angles, I can understand both arguments. There is a difference between someone gunning it into a pack of people on purpose and a reckless 22-year-old hitting the gas because his prefrontal cortex is fucked. When both result in the same outcome, four dead young women that had their whole lives ahead of them, because of the decision-making of one person, how much does it matter what was going on up here in that man's brain? Whether he had it in his head to hit the gas and hit the people. And I don't believe that that was in his head. But does it matter? If the decision-making process still ended in the same result? Does it matter what the goo in his mind was telling him to do? What those electronic impulses that make up our brain chemistry and function? Does it matter that one could have come from over here in a place of evil intent and one came over here from a place of ignorant, selfish, self-aggrandizing intent? Because one thought far too much of oneself that they were that invincible. Oftentimes people talk about young people and go, they all think they're invincible. They all think they don't. You have plenty that do. There's plenty of idiots out there. And to a certain extent, yes, we are all ignorant when we are young. We are all young and dumb at a point in our lives. Some far more dumb than others. But educating yourself, taking responsibility for your actions and choices, it doesn't just magically happen at 25 or whenever the prefrontal cortex is finally finished developing. You can start working on that early. You can start mimicking other people's decision-making. You can start learning how to make good decisions. You can start exercising that part of your brain and not just sit there and let people say, well, you can't do anything. You certainly can. You certainly can. Because I know myself. I know
most people that I'm close with, who exercise those sort of levers of maturity at a younger age, wouldn't have done something as stupid as this. And in the right environment, I don't know that this dipshit would have either. But when you grow up in an entitled space that allows you to do kind of anything you want to a certain extent, and look, I don't know all the details of Fraser Bohm's life, so this is kind of just coming in my own opinion. If some of those levers of responsibility and accountability were pulled at an earlier age and a little less entitlement, I don't know that he would have made the same choice. And that's environment. And that is on him. And it's on those around him. But it's not an impossibility to think that had some of those levers been pulled, he would have made the ignorant choice to do what he did that day. So how do you punish it? Four people are dead and they're never coming back. Does it matter if he was someone who had a hatred for women and wanted to mow them down, which I don't think he is at all, versus I can get away with this, I can do this, nothing's going to happen, it's going to be fine, until it's not. And then he has to face those consequences. Again, at the end, four young women are dead. Is there a difference in what that punishment should be? Is there certainly a difference in the mindset? Without a doubt. But should there be a difference in the consequences he faces for those actions? That's what a jury is going to decide. Tell me your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube. If you're not already there, Hitting Killers with Tony Brewski is where you will find us. And hit subscribe while you're there as well. We're trying to get to 100,000 subscribers by the end of the year. We're getting really close. We're over 80. We might make it. I don't know. Maybe early next year, unless you can help us. Please do hit subscribe. We really do appreciate that. You won't miss any of our commentaries and coverage of this and the many cases we got for you right here at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. I'm Tony Brewski. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers Podcast.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss. If your identity is stolen, LifeLock will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.